From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Donald Trump Jr. has been tweeting today that there's no inconsistency in his two conflicting statements about the meeting he now admits he had with a Russian lawyer during the campaign. He had first said it was to talk about adoption policies, then confirmed he met with the lawyer because she offered intelligence on Hillary Clinton. Of course, there are multiple investigations into the Trump campaign's ties to Russia, and his father, the president, had his own Russian-related tweets this weekend. Plus, Congress has just returned from a recess to debate health care legislation, so it's looking like another busy week in Washington. NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving is here. Ron, just when you thought you could put on some sunscreen and relax.
Oh, not really, Robin. Never,
no,
ever.
Never. Not this summer. Well, look, Kellyanne Conway, the president's counsel, was out today saying nothing happened at this meeting, that there wasn't any, you know, good information on Hillary Clinton, no action taken. But of course, Democrats and Republicans are asking, why didn't Donald Jr. admit to this meeting long ago when asked if he'd met with Russian officials or Russians? And what would he have done if there was good intelligence? So tell us more about why he says he took the meeting, who was there, what are the questions being raised?
He's been giving shifting explanations, and that's a big part of the problem. Kellyanne Conway said this morning that there was no evidentiary trail out of this meeting. If you watch a lot of TV, that's the kind of thing where you hear a person say, you'll never get that to stand up in court, copper. So it does draw a certain amount of attention and suspicion, and the shifting explanations are probably the biggest problem right at the moment. Initially, it was supposedly, we had no idea why we were meeting with this particular woman who was a Russian lawyer connected to the Kremlin, but she wanted to talk about adopting Russian kids, which was something that got shut down a while ago, and so we did it. Well, then the explanation suddenly became, well, we were told she might have damaging information about the Clinton campaign, but it turned out she didn't. So after that, we talked about adopting Russian kids. I'm not sure that's going to stand the test of most people's critical faculties.
Well, this comes as special counsel Robert Mueller is building his team to investigate connections between the Trump campaign and Russia. So how has the temperature changed in Washington? Has it?
It's raised the heat, obviously, but it's also changed the nature of the heat. We've gone from hot summer pavement here to something more like a bed of coals because it's becoming so much more bipartisan. The forehead slapping has really become a chorus. And we have probes underway in the House where the trajectory has been a little uncertain, but also in the Senate, which seems much more serious. And they're going to want to hear from Donald Jr. They're going to want to hear from some of the other people who were involved in this meeting. And we can also expect this to be of great interest to the special counsel, special prosecutor Robert Mueller, and his team, which keeps getting bigger.
Well, let's remember, this happens as President Trump met face-to-face with Vladimir Putin last Friday at that G20 summit and took criticism for proposing a joint cybersecurity effort with Russia. Here's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham on that on NBC's Meet the Press.
When it comes to Russia, he's got a blind spot, and to forgive and forget when it comes to Putin, yeah, regarding cyber attacks is to empower Putin. And that's exactly what he's doing.
Others have said, how could you work with a guy who did the hacks? I think that was John McCain. And President Trump seemed to backpedal on that idea. But your thoughts?
Later on in the same day, the president backpedaled. He was talking about it early Sunday morning via Twitter, and then later in the day, he was saying, that can't happen. But a ceasefire could, and it did. So let's talk about the ceasefire in Syria. And apparently the idea of a joint commission with the Russians to look into cyber security and hacking has already disappeared.
Yeah.
Although it was described by another Trump administration official, the Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, as a significant accomplishment when it was first found out about. So this seems to have been a very short-lived trial balloon, if that's what it was, or just sort of distracting idea.
Well, meanwhile, the Senate is back in session. Republican lawmakers struggling to build consensus on their health care legislation. White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus says they'll pass a bill by August. Senator John McCain says, no, it's going to fail. And they've got to reach across the aisle to work with Democrats. Your thoughts on what might happen there?
Mitch McConnell's talk about reaching across the aisle to work with Democrats might sound like the old Washington getting back to work and doing what needs to be done. But on the other hand, it's probably just a threat trying to get his troops back in line. He's been losing people left and right, quite literally. And let's look just for a quick moment at Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. Two numbers about West Virginia. It went for Trump by more than 40 points in the November election, but 30% of the families statewide are now on Medicaid. in West Virginia. So you look at those two numbers together, as surely Senator Capito has done, and you say, look, I'm all for Donald Trump, but I've got to have Medicaid for my constituents. So many of them depend on it. And so that's the kind of thing that's tearing this bill apart. You've got conservatives trying to make it more conservative, move it away from the, exactly the changes the moderates want.
Yeah. NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving, it's going to be quite a week. Thanks for being there.
Thank you, Robin.
Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has formally declared victory over ISIS in Mosul. ISIS had held the city since 2014 when it declared a caliphate there. The offensive to retake it began 9 months ago. Ben Watson, news editor at Defense One, has produced a comprehensive look at the battle. He joins us now to talk about it. Ben, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Magna. Great to be here.
Well, first of all, you've called this the largest military campaign in the world in nearly 15 years. So describe the scale of what has happened in Mosul.
So in Mosul, we were looking at an operation of almost every estimate puts it north of 100,000 troops that were collapsing. They're all allied with Baghdad to take control of Mosul, retake control of the city from ISIS. The last comparable-sized operation would have been the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and that clocked in at about 130,000 American troops. Now, of course, the big fundamental difference is that you have it was about 98,000, you know, Iraqi troops of various stripes, Sunni and Shia, and only about 500 or so Americans, a couple French, and so on.
Wow. So this campaign on Mosul, enormous by any stretch of the imagination. But as you write, those 100,000 troops were supported by air cover from half a dozen nations. And yet, obviously, this was not a cakewalk in any stretch of the imagination. So what are some of the lessons that we've learned?
I think the main lesson is how to deal with a deluge of IEDs, of vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, or suicide car bombs in particular. This conflict marked a use of those on a scale that had never been seen before, to my knowledge. We're talking about a frequency, even on kind of a slow day, of about five car bombs being thrown at the coalition any given 24-hour period. Those became a lot more dense and a lot more numerous, as you might imagine, as the city was falling more and more, and ISIS was isolated in a smaller number of neighborhood blocks around West Mosul.
Wow. So car bombs, and also you write about how ISIS fighters had artillery, conventional and improvised artillery as well?
They had quite a few factories that they'd come up with on their own. A lot of these ISIS fighters had come from, or some had come from, the Iraqi army back in the Saddam Hussein era. So you have a lot of officers who brought some expertise, kept it with them, and evolved and brought it to the level of homemade munitions where they would forge the metal themselves, shape it into a mortar, and then, of course, add these munitions for their drones that they had as well, opening up a whole new type of weapon, basically, that had not been seen before anywhere in war.
You also write that ISIS continued to use suicide bombers, including many more children as well.
It's a disturbing fact that I saw as the war was grinding on and coming to a close. Just the numbers of pictures that ISIS's own propaganda channels would pump out, celebrating the martyrdom, as they put it, of their fighters. And yes, absolutely. It was getting to be something that I sort of had a sense of. And then I saw a researcher named Charlie Winter point this out in a longer report about in February. The age of these fighters just was descending 20, 18, 15, and then some looked like they were as young as maybe 11 or 12.
So, Ben, let's circle back to a question that we asked earlier, and let me just phrase it a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. I mean, can an enormous effort like this be mounted to take back every ISIS stronghold in Iraq? I mean, is that one of the lessons we learned, or did we learn that, you know, it's going to be hard to root out ISIS using these methods because it takes so much manpower, so much air cover, so much coordination between Iraqi and coalition forces?
Well, I would be surprised if an operation of this measure developed in the coming even years, probably. The scale of this is so large, and the fact that they, you know, this was the number one city, the largest city that ISIS held anywhere across the world. So to get that kind of attention and that many parties to focus on one common goal is incredible. And the fact that if you could try to take that model and divert it over to Huija in Iraq, where ISIS still has a presence, or over to Tal Afar, or even farther a little bit west on the Euphrates River, where it crosses Syria into Iraq, That would be hard to imagine because of everybody understood Mosul was so important. It was the city where they announced the caliphate. So to see this model replicated elsewhere is I don't expect it.
Well, so as you pointed out, because Mosul is so important, this victory then for Iraqi forces is incredibly important. But, you know, we've also seen the fight against ISIS already change significantly sort of on a broader level, right? I mean, haven't they already switched tactics to carrying out or inspiring attacks in the West?
In a way, but that's something that that the coalition and the U.S. military has known for some time, and certainly that the U.S. military has been sort of grappling with various iterations of that in those insurgent sort of ways of striking back. It's still going to be quite a bit of time before the whole thing is eradicated. Nobody is saying that'll happen anytime soon.
Well, Ben Watson is news editor at Defense One. We have a link to his analysis of the Mosul offensive at hereandnow.org. Ben, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Magna.
And every now and then this summer, we're going to take a break from the news and get out to a lake. According to the EPA, there are over 120,000 of them in the U.S. Wikipedia has an amazing state-by-state list. Hey, a shout-out to everyone at Lake Strom Thurmond, which straddles Georgia and South Carolina. But as many lakes as there are many more lake memories. For me, there's the lily pad strangled lake on Long Island where I had my first terrifying snipe hunt at Girl Scout Camp Edie. There was learning to stand up paddleboard on a lake in Utah. My first pontoon on Lake Winnebago in Missouri. I think it's man-made. Water skiing on Lake George in upstate New York. If you have time to get away this summer, why not find a lake? Let's start our look at lakes with suggestions. What cool blue pools might be hiding or in plain sight in your area? Joe Yogerst is our guide. He's a travel writer, editor, and photographer, author of the recent National Geographic book, 50 States, 5,000 Ideas, Where to Go, When to Go, What to See, What to Do. He joins us from UC San Diego. Joe, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Okay, you're going to launch a million debates here, but what do you think is the best lake for swimming?
Oh, you know, I'm prejudiced when it comes to Western lakes because that's what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. And I have to say my favorite is Lake Mead, which is on the border between Nevada and Arizona, because I've been going there since I was a little kid, and some of my best lake memories are from there. But most of all, when it comes to swimming, I like warm water. And Lake Mead in the summer, it's like swimming in a bathtub.
Well, you know, I can hear people in upstate New York, you know, Saranac Lake, Lake George, saying, what, warm water? Or in Vermont, you know, where
sure.
Going into a lake involves that first plunge into the frigidness. But Lake Mead is warm.
And Lake Mead is the only place where you can float on your back and stare up at the walls of the Grand Canyon.
Tell us more about that.
Well, a lot of people don't know that Lake Mead backs up into the western part of the Grand Canyon. So in my college days, we used to rent houseboats and take it up into the Grand Canyon and sit there and play Trivial Pursuits at night and go swimming in the day. And I have very distinct memories of just floating on my back, looking up at the amazing walls, thinking, this is like the perfect place, perfect time, one of those moments.
That's, I think, what makes a lake great, if you have those memories. So go out and make them this summer. The National Park Service, by the way, calls Lake Mead America's most diverse national recreation area because of everything that you can do there. Talk about which you think, though, are the best wilderness lakes in the lower 48.
Yellowstone Lake, which is in Yellowstone National Park, and Lake Superior, which I just love also. And I think it's one of the great underutilized natural resources in this country, Lake Superior. It's huge. It's almost so big it's like a sea or an ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And it's surrounded by wilderness and amazing parks. Isle Royale National Park, which is in the middle of the lake. Pictured Rocks and Apostle Islands National Seashores, which are on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And it's surrounded by great cities like Duluth, Minnesota, Superior, Wisconsin. And there's also great wildlife.
Like what?
Well, the wolves of Isle Royale. It's one of the one places in the lower 48 where the wolves never disappeared from because they were basically protected by this island in the middle of Lake Superior where they weren't bothering livestock or farmers and no one was troubling them. So they managed to survive.
We read it is by surface area the largest lake in the world, contains as much water as the other great lakes combined, plus three Lake Eries. I visited a part once called Old Woman Bay, and I remember, you know, being from the East Coast, where I was used to lakes where voices echoed from the other side, being astonished at how big it was.
Yes.
And there was this vastness. Let's move a little further south. Lake Martin in Louisiana. Why is that on your list?
I spent a couple of days roaming around the middle of Louisiana looking for gators. And I finally found them at Lake Martin. And I found a lot of them, as in hundreds of them. And they were close enough to reach out and touch from the boat, although I obviously didn't do that. But this the wildlife in general there, it's not a large lake, but it's very well preserved with giant cypress trees coming up out of the water and wetlands all around, amazing bird life, turtles, fish, snakes, frogs, and a lot of gators.
But you're not water skiing there.
No, no, no. I mean, you can still fish on the lake. No water skiing. You pretty much have to go to Florida for that. The lakes around Orlando are amazing for wakeboarding, water skiing.
And now we're going to zip way up north. Lake Champlain, Vermont, New York, Burlington, Vermont there, just beautiful. But yes. Also, this is a great place if you're traveling in the summer with kids for a history lesson.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's kind of our forgotten war, the War of 1812, and a lot of it was fought on lakes, on Lake Michigan, Huron, Erie, Ontario, and Lake Champlain. The Battle of Lake Champlain, which happened in September of 1814, was actually a sea battle between the British Navy and a kind of a impromptu fleet of American ships that was built and launched on the lakeshore. And even though the British Royal Navy was a lot more experienced, the American sailors actually beat them in the Battle of Lake Champlain and foiled an entire invasion attempt to come down the Champlain Valley into the Hudson Valley and split the colony, well, the states at that point in half. So you have interpretive centers and museums about the War of 1812 on both sides of Lake Champlain today.
Well, we should note it's also called the Battle of Plattsburgh, just so we don't hear from everyone in Plattsburgh, New York. And by the way, while at Lake Champlain, you can drop down to Fort Ticonderoga.
You can.
Yeah.
You can drop down to Ticonderoga, and if you want to keep going south down to Saratoga Battlefield, which is on a river rather than a lake, but there's a lot of history through that whole corridor, not to mention the fact that you can go to the home of Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream, which is on the shores of Lake Champlain.
And they were also involved in the War of 1812. talk about, because we're going to be hearing from people who have that small lake that maybe, small enough that their family is the only one who knows about it. We want to hear those thoughts from people. But you mentioned Treasure Lake in Oklahoma and Trout Glen Pool in Missouri. Why?
Because they're very small, obscure little lakes, but both of them are gorgeous in their own way. Wichita Mountains National Wildlife Refuge really should be a national park, in my opinion. And Treasure Lake is in the middle of it. There's three lakes in the National Wildlife Refuge, and this is the most obscure one that you have to drive and then hike to. And it's just one of those wow moments when you get to the top of the trail and you look down upon this lake that's surrounded by these red rock cliffs, and you just don't expect it to be there the first time, and it really is a wow moment. Trout Glen Pool in Hahatonka State Park in Missouri, it's a tiny little branch of Lake of the Ozarks. The reason I like it is that it seems to have 20 different shades of blue all within about 100-yard range. It's just a gorgeous little lake that you can hike around. And if you really want to recreate, you cross a little isthmus, and the giant Lake of the Ozarks is right there. But, yeah, they're both small, obscure little lakes, which I think only local people mostly know about. But I happen to come across both of them. Well, yeah, maybe they are, yes.
It'll be a new sound. Lake? What lake? The little sign posted at the path now. Okay, here come your fighting words. In your opinion, you say Lake Tahoe in California is the most beautiful lake.
Yeah, of course. Like I said, I'm prejudiced about West Coast or Western lakes because that's what I grew up with. Lake Tahoe is just amazing, summer or winter, but I think it's especially beautiful in the winter with that mantle of snow all around. And it doesn't freeze over much because it's such a deep lake, but you get some ice around the edge, and it's just that kind of winter fairy tale.
Yeah. And you already said that another lake that you have childhood memories about is Lake Mead. But what's another, maybe one of the first lakes you ever visited, one that really stays with you?
Well, really the first true lake that I visited was Crater Lake in Oregon on a very early family driving vacation. I remember just being fascinated by Crater Lake, not because of the lake itself, but because of Wizard Island in the middle. This was long before Harry Potter, but I still had ideas about, there's a wizard? Is there a wizard that lives there? Is it a good wizard, a bad wizard? Does he have magical powers?
And what did you find out?
Well, I didn't find out anything because no one could tell me about the wizard. I was also fascinated by it as a child because of how deep it was. Because in those days, the standard for height was not a skyscraper in Dubai. It was still the Empire State Building. And I was just blown away by the fact that you could put the entire Empire State Building into the bottom of Crater Lake and the very top spire would not break the surface. That's how deep the lake was.
Oh, what a wonderful image. All right. Well, I'm sure there are people, you know, on this side of the country saying, oh, yeah, I'll see you your Crater Lake and top you with Lake George in New York. So, again, we want to hear from people. What's your favorite lake? And we're going to start visiting them over the summer. Joe Yogerst, travel writer and photographer. His recent book, 50 States, 5,000 Ideas, Where to Go, When to Go, What to See, What to Do. And a lot of it has to do with the lakes. Joe, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
We're now officially out of the 4th of July holiday week, officially more than halfway through the year. So how has the economy fared so far in 2017? There have been a lot of ups and downs in the last 6 months in oil prices, jobs numbers, the stock market. Here to walk us through some of the essential data points, Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money and her podcast Better Off. And Jill, as we begin, how are we going to say the word? Is it data or data?
Whatever you want.
Okay, I'm going with data.
Do it.
What data point for you best tells the story of 2017 so far?
Well, the broadest measure of economic growth is gross domestic product, GDP. And if you look at, say, the last 50 years, we look at GDP as average around 3% a year. But in the past decade, that rate has actually dropped down to 2%. 2015 was the best year of the recovery. It was up 2.6% we grew by, but in 2009, we were contracting by 2.8%. So in the first 6 months of this year, where do we stand? Kind of 2.25%. That's sort of where we've been for 3 years. I should also mention that in terms of GDP, we are now officially in the 97th month of this expansion. It's the third longest in U.S. history. That's according to our friends at the National Bureau of Economic Research.
But what does that mean?
Well, what it means is that the economy is growing, but what it doesn't mean is it's growing fast enough for everyone. And that brings me to another point in this process, which is, you know, look at something like the labor market and you say, hey, you know, it's great. We had a good jobs report in June and millions of people are back to work. Yes, that's all well and good. And we are averaging 180,000 jobs a month this year. Also good. But wages are just not rising very fast. And there are a lot of people who are so frustrated because essentially they really haven't seen a robust enough wage gains to feel good about this recovery.
Well, especially if they're watching the stock market. And they may not be in the stock market, but in January, the Dow hit, you know, 20,000, has climbed even higher. But we know from recent history, soaring stock markets don't tell the whole story. So what does that tell us?
Well, I mean, it tells you that corporate America is making money. And that's kind of an interesting thing, because at the end of last year, from the election on, the market was rising in anticipation, saying, hey, you know what? We're going to get tax reform, infrastructure spending, regulatory reform. Isn't that all good? And that has not happened, obviously. So why is the market up this year? It has a lot to do with companies making money. Corporate profits are up. But you're right in that almost half of this country doesn't own a stock, right, doesn't own a mutual fund, doesn't have a retirement account. So this is great for some people, but it tells you more about what we think companies are doing rather than the economy as a whole.
Well, and critics are saying, let's connect those two dots. If corporate America is doing so well, let some of that trickle down to higher wages. But that's the debate. Finally, though, you talk about all this growth. The concern, inflation, too much growth. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen will testify before Congress this week. What can we expect?
You're not going to get a lot, but I think she's going to get some questions from lawmakers about when is the Fed going to raise rates next. It's not as if she's going to say, oh, yes, put this date in your day timer, folks, and here it is. It's data dependent. I said data. They're also going to ask her about what about all those bonds that the Fed bought during the financial crisis? How are you going to unwind them? There is going to be some slow selling and peeling off of those positions. The Federal Reserve now has over $4 trillion on its balance sheet. That's up almost four times from the before the recession. So we're going to see that. We're going to have a lot of conversation about that. And it will be in the eyes of those lawmakers, yeah, as she sits before them.
Jill Schlesinger of CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Take care.
Turkey detained more than 36 people today for their alleged ties to Fethullah Gulen, the U.S.-based cleric that the Turkish government claims instigated a failed coup a year ago this week. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan launched a crackdown following the failed coup, and more than 50,000 people have been arrested. However, that crackdown has not stopped people from protesting. Here's some sound from a huge demonstration yesterday.
Bundan tam 25 gün önce Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu öncülüğünde Ankara Güven Park'tan hareket eden...
The BBC's Mark Lowen joins us from Istanbul. And Mark, first of all, tell us about this demonstration yesterday. How big was it? What was it all about?
It was absolutely enormous, Meghna. Hundreds of thousands of people who gathered in Istanbul at the culmination of a 3.5 week long march across Turkey from Ankara to Istanbul, 250 miles, about 480 kilometers. People had trudged through boiling heat and rain up through hills and villages and along motorways, all under the word adalet, which means justice. Now, this was sparked when an opposition MP was jailed about a month ago. And it began with a march led by the opposition leader, a sprightly 68-year-old. And every day it would gather thousands more people. I joined them for a day marching 21 kilometers in the boiling 35 degree heat. They were calling for the rule of law. They were calling for an end to mass jailings and suspensions, and then it culminated in this enormous rally in Istanbul. And really, when you look at the aerial shots, I mean, the entire area along the seaside of Istanbul was just absolutely packed with people as the opposition leader called for an end to what he called the dictatorship.
Interesting. Now, of course, for U.S. listeners, 35 degrees centigrade, as you were referring to. So we're talking about 100 degrees or so Fahrenheit. So boiling temperatures, Mark, as you were saying. But let me ask you, I mean, given the violence that surrounded the failed coup last year, were the protesters met with any pushback from Erdogan's government?
President Erdogan hit out very harshly against them. He said the march was supporting terrorism, and the government did its best to downplay the final rally in Istanbul. The pro-government media largely ignored it or did very small news items on it. But this was a big show of strength, and it clearly shook President Erdogan. It was the biggest show of defiance, act of defiance, since the failed coup last year. It was really a sign that while half the country still loves him and sees him as their savior, the more religious, more conservative, more pious side of Turkey, the other side, arguably more dynamic, certainly more urban, higher paid, more secular and liberal, feel that they are not going to take this all lying down. They're trying to resist. The question now, Meghna, is whether they can transform and channel that energy from this social movement into a real political challenge against Erdogan in the elections in 2019.
So the split is roughly 50-50 in terms of support and opposition to Erdogan?
It really is. I mean, when you look at the election results, whether it's presidential election or this referendum he held back in April to extend his powers, it really is a 50-50 split. There's one side that absolutely reveres him, and there's one side that reviles him. He splits the nation down the middle, if you like. Even though he talks about himself as being the great unifier, Turkey is more polarized today than perhaps ever in its modern history.
Okay, fascinating. So let's talk for a moment about the failed coup last year, because of course it was the most public display to the world community about how deep this rift is. I mean, July 15th, 2016, just remind us what happened.
It took everybody by surprise. Suddenly, late in the evening, troops arrived on the Bosphorus Bridge, which, for those of you who know Istanbul, is the first bridge, the first of three bridges that crosses the Bosphorus. And they seized the bridge and blocked it off. Shortly after that, rebel soldiers commandeered planes and started bombing government buildings, including Parliament in Ankara, the intelligence headquarters. Tanks were driven into civilians. It was arguably the gravest ever attack on the Turkish state, as a section of rogue soldiers tried to seize control of the country. They tried to take control of the state broadcaster, and they declared that a military council had taken control of the country. President Erdogan was holidaying down on the Turkish coast. He managed to get away from an attempted capture and flew to Istanbul, making a FaceTime call, a video call,
right,
calling thousands of people out onto the streets to resist it. And that succeeded. succeeded, so the coup failed, and then this massive nationwide purge began to arrest what he called, and what the government called, alleged sympathizers of the coup plotter.
Okay, so let's talk about this alleged coup plotter, Fethullah Gulen, who lives in Pennsylvania. Tell us more about him, and, you know, is there evidence that he was truly the mastermind of the attempt last year?
That's the $64,000 question. He's been living in Pennsylvania since 1999. He used to be very close allies with Recep Tayyip Erdogan. They helped kind of Islamize, in a sense, a previously more constitutionally secular country. But then they fell out very badly in 2013 when a corruption scandal broke that appeared to implicate Erdogan and his inner circle, and he blamed Gulen and his followers. Over the decades, Gulen has endowed schools and universities here. He's got followers in education, business, in all sectors of Turkish society. And what the government says is that it is a virus and that they need to cleanse and get rid of all his followers from every sector of society. Critics, though, say that this is an attempt to crush dissent, and that it is only when the Gulen movement turned on Erdogan that finally Gulen became the enemy, and that actually for years Erdogan was helping Gulen infiltrate the state, and that the government should bear responsibility as well for that. In terms of the evidence, the government says that Gulen orchestrated the coup and his followers in Turkey obeyed him. And the Turks have asked for the U.S. to extradite him immediately to Turkey. What the White House and what Washington are saying is that needs to go through the courts. It needs to be an independent judicial decision. And also, at the moment, the intelligence services of various European countries are saying that they believe that some Gulen followers were involved in the coup, but that it's going to be very difficult to pin this on Fethullah Gulen himself.
Well, Mark, let me ask you, where does this leave President Erdogan? Because Turkey, for generations, has been strategically important, obviously, not just for itself, but for Europe and the United States. President Trump has made supportive gestures towards President Erdogan. But has that helped Erdogan, or is he in as precarious a position as you described earlier?
At the start, it seemed like there was going to be a new era of cooperation between the U.S. and Turkey with the Trump administration. Two presidents are they have similarities in many ways. They're both kind of populists. They don't have much time for the free press, although it's taken to far greater extent here, where Turkey is the world's biggest jailer of journalists. But it has become increasingly clear that the Trump administration is not necessarily going to take a different line when it comes to Fethullah Gulen. Washington still believes it needs to go through the courts, whereas here in Turkey, if President Erdogan wanted somebody deported, he would just take that decision and the courts would comply, because there's very little judicial independence. In countries like the US, that's obviously not the case. The two have they've met in Washington, they've spoken, they met just recently at the G20 in Hamburg. But at the moment, there are big sticking points. Fethullah Gulen is number one among them, but also they disagree on other issues like Syria.
So does this mean that the opposition then feels that there's reason to be hopeful that their push for change could perhaps eventually yield some results?
The big problem here with the opposition is that President Erdogan is an extremely dominant character. He absolutely is the man of the, not just the moment, but the man of the decade in Turkish politics. And the opposition lacks that. The opposition is very fragmented. You've got the secular leftists, you've got the Kurds, you've got sort of far-left social democrats, etc. And they need to coalesce around one figure if they're going to manage to challenge Erdogan in the next election in 2019. There's talk of a new party being formed on the right wing, nationalists, to challenge Erdogan. But it's going to be very, very difficult to do that. I mean, Erdogan has won every electoral challenge that he has faced, be it local election, presidential election, this referendum. So, yes, there is clearly half the country that feels that Turkey is heading in a disastrous direction. Just a few days ago, 10 international human rights activists were arrested here for allegedly being part of an armed terrorist organization. The European Union says that Turkey uses this word terrorism or propaganda for terrorism far too widely to encompass any kind of criticism. So clearly there is a desire in half the country to resist that. They just need to find somebody to bring them together, and somebody credible enough to challenge Erdogan in a couple of years' time.
That's the BBC's Mark Lowen speaking to us today from Istanbul. Mark, thank you so much.
Pleasure, Magna.
there's no question America is divided over information sources. People of different political persuasions getting their news from different places. And polls show they have sharply opposing views on everything from the general direction of the country to the Trump administration's travel ban to what is a fact. Well, this clash of beliefs is having a big impact on how friends get along on Facebook, how people interact in their communities. We did a story recently on how this division is negatively impacting reunions. So against that reality, here's a surprising story from Erica Lance at Here Now contributor WBUR. It's about two people you'd think would be the last to reconcile their conflicting beliefs.
Ted Hakey Jr. was a former Marine living with his wife in Meriden, Connecticut, when he says he started to feel uneasy toward Muslims. With each story of another terrorist attack, his resentment grew. So he admits he was concerned in 2007 when a new Ahmadiyya mosque opened across from his house. Ted watched his neighbors through binoculars.
I look out one day, the place is like a beehive. And there was all kinds of, you know, men coming and going. And then I was like, wait a minute here. And I'm thinking they're plotting.
Ted, who was in his 40s, lived next to the mosque for years without incident. And then came November 13th, 2015.
Carnage and horror on the streets of Paris.
Deadly explosions
tonight.
At a packed sports stadium. Machine guns.
Terrorists killed 130 people in Paris that night and injured hundreds more. In Connecticut, just hours after the attack, Ted was returning home from a night out.
Got out of the car and was walking in, and I kind of looked over and I saw the mosque.
The more he looked at it that night, the more worked up he got. He decided he needed to act.
Keep him on edge.
So Ted took out his rifle and pointed at the mosque.
Kind of think, well, I'm going to do something, you know, in case there was an extremist in there. And my drunken Jack Daniels thinking, I was thinking that, oh, it'll scare them and they might think twice. You know, shot off some rounds.
He shot round after round into the dark. Ted claims he was aiming for the ground, but four bullets hit the mosque, which was fortunately empty.
When I had gotten to the mosque and seen the bullet wounds, the wall being split, we were like, you know, why would anybody do this?
The mosque's outreach director, Zahir Manan, was shaken. Just a few hours before Ted took aim, Zahir and his children had been at the mosque in the room the bullets pierced.
Right through the prayer hall.
Then Zahir learned the shooter was their neighbor, and the authorities showed him Ted's Facebook posts.
He said that all Muslims must die.
I'm spying on them with my binos.
This is war.
If everybody just killed one Muslim, then we would make a dent.
It disturbs Zahir that their neighbor could miss all the good they were trying to do.
Immediately we thought, where did we go wrong? If he spied on us, did he not see our blood drive sign?
Or the sign out front with their motto, love for all, hatred for none. The mosque leaders decided to meet this Ted Hakey. Ted, in the meantime, now more clear-headed, had come to feel terrible regret. So he met with mosque representatives, including Zahir.
The first thing he did when he came in was that he started crying, and it kind of brought us to tears.
They'd already planned to forgive him, but something more profound was happening.
We both were really shocked at how sincere the other side was.
Ted sat down in front of Zahir and his wife and others and apologized.
You could see he was a little bit uncomfortable, but he was also very sorry. He's not a bad guy.
Then Zahir told Ted about Islam. And Ted started asking questions.
They actually were doing more against extremism than I was. And I just realized all the misconceptions I had about Islam were wrong because I didn't know any actual Muslims.
The next week, the congregation's leader invited Ted to visit the mosque. In the prayer hall still marked by his bullets, Ted apologized. And in front of everyone, the leaders hugged him. Then it was time for prayer.
He just said, I want to pray with you. I said, follow me. And then we bow down. That's when he became my brother.
It was the beginning of a real friendship. Ted brought his friends to the mosque for interfaith events, and mosque members showed up at Ted's sentencing to ask for leniency. Later, when Ted was serving time, Zahir regularly visited him in prison. Ted says if Zahir hadn't been so kind, his life would look very different.
None of my attitude would have changed. I would still have the same beliefs I always did. And it's the way that they responded, and this is what changed me.
After serving 6 months, Ted's out of prison and on a mission to reach people who still learn about Islam the way he once did, through negative Facebook posts.
And I've had hundreds of conversations on Facebook and arguments with people, and they're afraid, oh no, I'll get, you know, they'll chop off my head and stuff. I'm like, I'm telling you now, you know, if they didn't chop my head off, I think you're good. I just want to tell people to think for themselves.
Ted's gotten into the habit of tagging Zahir in the comments so he can chime in too. And suddenly, people who have never met a Muslim are going back and forth with one about how to interpret the Quran. Ted and Zahir are talking across divides that are ripping a lot of the country apart. What they're doing might look small, but Zahir sees something bigger.
As a miracle of, like, biblical proportions.
For Here and Now, I'm Erica Lance.
Erica's story came to us from Kind World, a podcast produced by Here and Now contributor WBUR. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.